the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is brought to you by great Americans who subscribe, including Yolanda Wandell, Bonnie Baker, Eugene Kenny, and Lauren Howard. You want to join that infamous group? All the details are on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, we're going to meet Sarah Sheward. She and two male friends were picked up by the Iranians when they were hiking along the Iran-Iraq border in 2009, and she was held in solitary confinement for more than a year in Tehran. She's now an activist in opposition to solitary confinement. She has quite a story to tell and some street cred, if you ask me. The Oils from Down Under, Midnight Oil, led by the formerly liberal Peter Garrett. And it's called My Country, Right or Wrong. And that's the way some people respond when a president like Barack Obama signs the National Defense Authorization Act, which allows the government to accuse you or me of some murky connection to terrorism and then lock us up without charge or trial indefinitely, perhaps at a military base. Carl Mayer returns to our program today with his co-counsel, Bruce Afrin. He has been managing a critical case brought by journalist Chris Hedges, former Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg, and other plaintiffs. And they were successful at the trial court level in persuading Judge Catherine Forrest in New York District Court to issue a permanent injunction against Section 1021 of the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, and in particular, subpart B, which included this murky language that could permit an American to be detained, as I suggested. Carl Mayer has an exclusive update for us today here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Carl, welcome.
Thank you, Peter B. Always great to be on your show. Thank you for being the only person who has been following this critical litigation since day one and getting the word out.
Well, I want my Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights back, Carl, and you're working on it with this case and others, and I really appreciate what you do. So just to recap briefly, you brought suit. There were initial hearings held in March. There were additional hearings held in May. And on September 12th of this year, Judge Catherine Forrest, on the federal bench in New York, issued a 112-page blistering decision, which excoriated the government for its the way it participated in this case with arrogance and seeming indifference. And she delivered for you and your plaintiff clients this permanent injunction against this so-called Homeland Battlefield bill. And then it only took 5 or 6 days for the Obama administration first to smear the judge from the White House press room, then to claim that this law would prevent them from detaining individuals in Afghanistan, which is a real stretch. And then they found an appeals court judge who issued a temporary stay that was followed on October 2nd of this year by a permanent stay of the permanent injunction issued by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. So if that's a good recap, tell me what the news is today about actions that you are taking to appeal the blocking of the injunction.
Sure. Well, a couple of minor amendments to what you said, Peter. First of all, Judge Forrest, the district judge in New York, the federal district judge, had issued a preliminary injunction on May 16th that had blocked the NDAA and blocked the ability of the military to pick up American citizens on our streets. And we were very grateful for that. And that injunction had been in place from May 16th all the way up until September 12th. And so for that period, U.S. citizens and any civilians in this country were protected from this heinous law. And we were very grateful for that victory. You know, we received what we thought was another victory on September 12th when Judge Forrest made the injunction permanent.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, the Obama administration then went into overdrive to appeal this injunction. They worked throughout the weekend, late into Friday night, they gave notice that they were going to work over the weekend and file papers. And the Second Circuit, which is the appeal court, they didn't issue a permanent stay. That's the only correction I had to what you said.
All right.
They issued a temporary stay pending an appeal.
Okay.
And the appeal is going forward in the Second Circuit, and we're in the middle of briefing that. And the briefing will be completed in 10 days' time on December 20th. And shortly thereafter, there should be an oral argument on this. But in the meantime, we've now gone to the Supreme Court of the United States. What we filed today was an emergency motion with the Supreme Court of the United States asking them to lift the temporary stay. Because what we're arguing to the Supreme Court is even if the stay is temporary, what it has the effect of doing is allowing the NDAA to operate and to allow detention of U.S. citizens, civilians, etc. So this is, we think, a very critical emergency motion. We have said to the Supreme Court, essentially, that the status quo has always been in this country that the military doesn't police our streets. Period. End of story. The military cannot detain U.S. citizens or any civilians in this country. The military cannot interfere with our civil justice system that is guaranteed by the Constitution. And that's a 200-year-old principle. It goes back to the Posse Comitatus statutes. It goes back to Supreme Court opinions decided as early as shortly after the U.S. Civil War. And for the Second Circuit to issue a stay for any amount of time effectively upends that status quo. So what we did to the Supreme Court today is we said, listen, we think that the federal government, that the Obama administration and the Justice Department are actually, in essence, not being straightforward with the court. Because the Obama administration, before the Second Circuit, said to the court that, oh, well, U.S. citizens like our plaintiffs, Christopher Hedges and Daniel Ellsberg and the other activists, oh, they're not in danger under the NDAA. Well, that's a big surprise to us because at trial before Judge Forrest back in March, the government refused to say that these journalists and other plaintiffs weren't in danger. In fact, they specifically said on the record, we can't give them any guarantees. We can't give one of our plaintiffs who's a member of Iceland's parliament, an ally of hers, we can't give her assurances that if she travels to the United States, she won't be detained under the NDAA. That's a sitting member of parliament who's an ally of the United States. They couldn't even give her assurances of that on the record in court. And then they lost the preliminary injunction. And once they lost the preliminary injunction, they started to hedge their position. It's like the old two-step, the old sidestep. It's unbelievable. They had a shifting position. Then they tried to say, oh, well, if people are journalists and they're engaged in independent expression, blah, 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 maybe they wouldn't be detained under the NDAA. And then finally they said in front of the Second Circuit, oh, no, these people won't be detained under the NDAA. And by saying that, they got the Second Circuit to grant the stay. which I think was a big mistake, and that's why we went to the Supreme Court of the United States today.
Now, Carl, help me out here, because as you know, I'm not a lawyer. I respect the law, and I've learned a lot about it. But as I understand it, an appeals court can only deal with technical issues that are raised about defects in the process or the interpretation of the law, or in the case of a jury trial, instructions to the jury, that sort of thing. So it appears that in the October 2nd opinion that was issued by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, that they fudged the facts that had been presented by you and, in general, unchallenged by the government at trial, and asserted without any, you know, new evidence being presented or any other process that, oh, what are you worrying about? You know, on the face of it, the statute doesn't affect the existing rights of American citizens, and that based on the stated activities of the plaintiffs, that they are in no danger whatsoever of ever being captured and detained by the U.S. military. Now, those are sweeping statements, and what precisely are they based on?
They're not based on anything, because the government, when there was a trial before the district court, Judge Forrest, they were given the opportunity to call a witness, including any witness from the government, from the Department of Defense, the CIA, the NSA, the Homeland Security, any of the intelligence agencies, the national security agencies, could have presented a witness who would issue a certification or some sort of sworn statement saying that U.S. citizens and civilians are not to be subject to detention, they're not to be subject to extraordinary rendition, they're not to be subject to military trial. They declined to do that. They didn't do that. And they wouldn't, even their lawyers, because the only statements the government made was through their lawyers. There was no witnesses that they put in, no facts that they put in. The only statement was through their lawyers, who refused to give guarantees of that people wouldn't be detained, including to these plaintiffs. So that's one of our arguments to the Supreme Court, and you picked up on that very nicely, Peter. What we said to the Supreme Court is that under the appellate rules, in order to get a stay, the government would have had to put in some sort of affidavit, either below in the trial court or even at the Second Circuit level. Mm-hmm. They didn't put in any evidence. They put in zero evidence. All they did was rely on the representation of their attorney. And for that reason alone, we think the Supreme Court should overturn the stay and stop this NDAA in its tracks.
And, Carl, what got me pumped up about this was right before the election, I had a very interesting and, I will say, respectful exchange on Facebook with a guy I've never met who pulled up a quote from the opinion of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and said, "See, you ninnies who are complaining about Obama and the NDAA don't realize that Americans have been excluded." So, and let me just add to that that in the current deliberations, such as they are, about the NDAA for the coming year, for 2013, the Senate did vote to include the Feinstein Amendment, which is an attempt, and not a clean one, to clarify this language to exclude Americans. That tells me that the reading of even this expanded opinion by the Second Circuit Court is not clear enough, and that the vagueness of the language in the bill about what is material support and you know, who are the targeted groups is so vague that this required clarification. So while the Feinstein Amendment is still problematic, and perhaps we'll have time to discuss that, to me, that's a fundamental evidence that the NDAA from 2012 is not clear.
Right. I mean, the very fact the very fact that the entire Senate had to vote to clarify the 2012 NDAA, and there are plenty of lawyers in the Senate, tells you that the language wasn't clear.
Mm-hmm.
And this is somewhat of a comical thing we have going here, because obviously the United States Senate and all the lawyers therein are unanimous now that the language of the 2012 NDAA was not clear. But at the same time, the Justice Department lawyers are putting in papers to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals saying, absolutely, the language is 100% crystal clear. Clear as water. crystal clear, clear as water, that citizens and others cannot be detained. So there's that complete contradiction. And, you know, obviously the language is not clear. It's clear as mud. It is, that's what Judge Forrest, the district court judge, found below. She found it was completely vague and therefore unconstitutional. You can't have a vague law that doesn't give Americans certainty as to what their rights are, whether they are entitled to a trial by jury. It doesn't give them certainty about what they can publish, what they can speak, what they can write. And because that chills their speech, and it's a First Amendment violation.
Now, Carl, this leads me to ask for further clarification because, again, as you know, based on my own understanding, the 2012 NDAA was a budget bill to provide funding for the Pentagon, but included was this language, which clearly survives the fiscal year that the NDAA covers. And now we have language that is different in the NDAA for 2013. Which one is controlling?
Well, for now, 2012 is controlling, especially since the 2013 bill has not been passed by Congress and hasn't been signed by the president.
Yeah, it's passed the Senate, but I don't believe the House has passed it.
Right, the House hasn't passed it, and then it would have to go to conference, and then the president would sign it. Even if it were to pass, at that point, there are still many, many constitutional deficiencies to the Feinstein Amendment. In fact, the sponsors of the bill, Feinstein and the and Rand Paul and Lee and others, they admitted straight up that the language that they proposed and that was passed in the Senate doesn't solve the problem of protecting non-U.S. citizens,
right,
who aren't a permanent resident in the U.S. So that's a pretty broad category. That's, you know, all foreign students, tourists, people who are here on temporary work visas. That's a lot of folks that aren't protected at all.
Mm-hmm.
And even their claim that U.S. citizens are protected along with permanent residents is not correct, because there's a provision in the Feinstein Amendment that allows, that says that citizens can't be, U.S. citizens can't be detained unless authorized by an act of Congress. Well, I mean...
like the 2012 NDAA.
Well, like the 2012 NDAA, like, according to the government, in all their papers, they say that the AUMF gives them the authority to detain people wherever they want, whenever they want, and mm-hmm. that the NDAA is just the same as the AUMF.
Well, and so, that was the argument that Judge Forrest ruled against,
correct,
in her September 12th decision, and caused her to be dinged by this appeals court, saying that somehow she improperly narrowed the interpretation of the post 9/11 blank check, the authorization for use of military force.
Correct. So it's clear as mud. And because it's clear as mud, we already have one district judge who found the 2012 Homeland Battlefield Act completely unconstitutional on several grounds. We have no doubt that unless something changes with the 2013 version, if it's passed and signed by the president, that would be similarly unconstitutional, and we would continue to challenge that. As I suspected, that both versions would be merged, and there would the government would say that our appeal is moot, or at least partially moot. But we'll keep making arguments that it's not, and we're going to keep fighting all the way to the Supreme Court. But I'll tell you what: even if in fact U.S. citizens are protected under the 2013 NDAA, and if in fact long-term residents, legal residents, are protected, then we've won the battle. That's what we started this fight for. So if, in fact, they're protected, we've won. To the extent that they're not protected, we're going to keep fighting all the way up to the Supreme Court until the Supreme Court either rules that everyone is fully protected or we get as much as we can out of that legal process. Because What's clear is that the executive branch, rubber stamped by the legislative branch in the national security area, can't be trusted. And the only check on this ever-expanding war power and war state and surveillance state of Obama and Bush, the only check on that is the judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're here.
Carl, I want to recommend, if listeners are hearing about this for the first time, do a search for Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, in the search window at peterbcollins.com, and you'll hear our previous interviews, including the one from mid-September, and in the show file there, there is a link directly to the 112-page decision by Judge Forrest, and I encourage people who haven't seen that to read over it, because you will see how flatly unconstitutional she finds the language in this provision, and how she cited precedents from the conservative wing of the Supreme Court regarding some of this language. And we now have the most recent Hamdan decision, which declared that the term material support couldn't be used against a Guantanamo detainee because that language didn't exist until what I call the Stalin Act of 2006, which reinstated military commissions and finally provided a definition for so-called material support. But one other whack here at the debate over the current legislation, Carl, and that is that it creates a new distinction between citizens and residents in the United States, where previously the broad language used was U.S. persons. And a U.S. person was defined as a citizen or any legal resident of the United States. Do you find that to be problematic?
Yeah, absolutely. It creates another level of confusion and ambiguity. And it leaves out whole categories of people that aren't protected. And American jurisprudence has drawn a very clear line up until now, which is civilians and U.S. citizens, at least within the domestic United States, are absolutely protected from any military detentions. The military can't police our streets or interfere with our justice system. And that's the principle we're fighting for. And The 2013 Feinstein Amendment does nothing to ensure that eventuality for a large part of America. It might, and I emphasize might, protect U.S. citizens and permanent residents, but I don't even think that is clear.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we're ever going to get clarity is to keep doing what we're doing, which is forcing the issue in the court. And frankly, I'm hoping that both the Second Circuit and the Supreme Court will agree with us, and that they'll provide some protection for Americans and some clarity in this area, because just as a matter of judicial economy for the Supreme Court and all the federal courts below, unless you clarify this area, it's just going to lead to habeas petitions, endless habeas petitions, when we know that people are detained. But even worse, it's going to chill speech. There was all sorts of testimony that came out at the trial court level before Judge Forrest about how these very distinguished journalists like Chris Hedges, like Daniel Ellsberg, the author of the Pentagon Papers, these young activists, even a member of Iceland's parliament, how all of them had changed their daily activity because they were concerned about being caught up in the net of the NDAA. And as long as this uncertainty is out there, it really has a daily impact in freezing civil liberties in America and freezing freedom of expression. And we have to break that logjam. And it's one part of fighting the national security state. There are all these other measures that the government has taken to have wiretaps of Americans' homes without warrants, have drones flying over the United States, to engage in targeted assassinations. This, you know, I think in American history, I'm hoping in American history, that this 10-year period, 12-year period, will be seen as the Bush-Obama interregnum, where there was this massive assault on civil liberties. But I'm hoping that the court and the people will pull us back from this. You might know, Peter, I think it was just last week that the legislature in Michigan passed unanimously, both houses, a measure that denounced the NDAA and made it the law of the state of Michigan that the state guard and local law enforcement may not by law cooperate with the military armed forces in trying to detain civilians in the state of Michigan.
Well, I fully support that, but this week they unraveled any respect I had for them by ramming through this anti-union right-to-work legislation.
We can't ascribe too much to the state of Michigan, but their legislature. But what was interesting was that this was a completely bipartisan vote.
Mm-hmm.
It was unanimous. I think it was 107-0. And I think they wouldn't have voted that way if it weren't the sense of the people that this attempt to militarize America has gone too far.
Yeah. Carl, to the extent you're willing to discuss your strategy here, what is the idea of pursuing the appeal while you also call for an emergency stay of the stay from Justice Ginsburg?
Well, I mean, if the Supreme Court were to lift the stay, that would mean that the NDA would not have any effect while the stay was lifted, and we would still have to go through the appeal process in the Second Circuit and probably even the Supreme Court. They would have to reach the merits of our claim to see whether, in fact, Judge Forrest was right in declaring the statute to be unconstitutional. I think she was. I think we have a tremendous record before Judge Forrest. It is unrebutted by the government. So I think that the strategy has to be a dual strategy. We want the stay lifted as quickly as possible because that means that Americans are protected while the Second Circuit and probably the Supreme Court hear this appeal. If the Supreme Court doesn't lift the stay, it means the Obama administration is free to do what it wants until the courts decide whether the federal judge below is correct.
And what would be the procedure here? Can Justice Ginsburg, she's the regional justice, I presume, that is assigned to the Northeast, can she do this individually, or does it require a vote of the full court?
No, she could lift the stay herself.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if she declines to do it, we can appeal to another justice.
Okay.
But the point is, this is the emergency application before the Supreme Court is pretty extraordinary. But I got to tell you, this entire procedure is pretty extraordinary in the law because just for the federal judge to enjoin an act of Congress as unconstitutional is very rare and is an extraordinary action, and only relatively few acts of Congress have been declared unconstitutional in our nation's history. But it is equally extraordinary for the Second Circuit just to issue a stay, for even a temporary stay, that reverses the injunction and upends the status quo. A stay is a very extraordinary action by a court, and so that's why we've now gone to another level.
Carl, finally, I've been able to read about a third of your 63-page filing. What else is in there when I get to it that you want to point out to our listeners?
There are a few things in the filing that I think are relevant. I mean, the first point is that if the Supreme Court really looks at the record before, and this was, our brief was 60 pages, and then I think we had almost 600 pages of the transcripts and the opinions below.
Mm-hmm.
But if the court really looks at the fact record, what they'll find here is that the government specifically would not grant any insurances to either a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times reporter, a distinguished author of the Pentagon Papers, a member of Iceland's parliament. They would not grant any insurances to those people that they could not be detained by military.
And don't leave out Tangerine Boland. I love her hair.
Yes, right.
I think
I don't mean to give a short shrift to these four young activists who are fantastic. They're less well known than the older mm-hmm. activists like Noam Chomsky. But there's Tangerine Boland and there's Tai Wargala who started Occupy London. Tangerine Boland started Revolution Truth. There's Alexa O'Brien, who started a U.S. Day of Rage. I mean, all these people are very dedicated to reforming our country in a nonviolent way. And what all of them share is that they've all had a brush with the U.S. military complex, which somehow, in the case of Hedges, he was actually detained while he was reporting in Iraq. In the case of Jonstadir, the Iceland parliamentarian, her Twitter account was subpoenaed and her bank records were subpoenaed, and she was told by her minister that she couldn't fly to the U.S. and the government attorneys at the proceedings below would not guarantee her passage to the U.S. So all that is very clear on the record. As in terms of our legal argument to the court, I think one of the key things you alluded to earlier, and I just want to tease it out a little bit, is that a case called Hamdan, which was decided just last month, struck down even the material support standard as being too vague to detain someone with. And if that's the case, the material support standard actually is in a statute that has a definition section. It has some content to it. Nonetheless, the D.C. Circuit ruled that's not sufficient to detain someone. That standard of material support is more precise than the substantially supported standard of the NDAA, which is entirely vague. And so I think that opinion is very important. And I think the Supreme Court, in weighing whether to lift the stay, I hope, will be looking at that. So that's the other argument that we made to the court. And, really the main argument we made to the court is if they don't lift the stay, they've allowed the Second Circuit in a lightning-fast three-page opinion to totally upend the law in this area that's been settled for 200 years. And they ought not to be allowed to do that pending the appeal here.
Well, and frankly, that strikes me as a kind of judicial sleight of hand, which is reminiscent of the case that we discussed in great detail earlier this year, Montana's appeal of its ban on corporate political contributions, where the case file name was changed in a way that appears to have allowed the court to deny that appeal without hearing any arguments related to the 11th Amendment, which was what you and your client Adam Furgach had raised. Any comment on that?
Well, yeah, it is. I think it was. I think it was partly a sleight of hand, and it was also partly, I believe, that the Second Circuit was duped by the executive branch into believing that somehow plaintiffs in this case are safe when the executive branch made it clear on the record in open court that they're not safe, and that Americans who engage in independent journalism or activism are not safe either as long as the NDAA is in effect.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, we thought it was very unfortunate that they granted the temporary stay. So, having said that, we hope that the panel we get in the Second Circuit will fairly consider the merits and rule to affirm Judge Forrest.
Do you have any prediction? I know the Supreme Court justices have great discretion, but is there any time limit on the requirement for Justice Ginsburg to respond to this emergency filing?
No, there's no time limit. Ordinarily, they do these things in a matter of days, maybe weeks, which is lightning fast in the law. The Supreme Court can do whatever they want. They're the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
She could just deny it. She could just grant it, or she could, have a short hearing on the matter and delve into it more. And I can't say what'll happen.
Well, Carl, do keep us posted on both tracks, on the appeal to the Supreme Court to lift the stay and on the full appeal at the Second Circuit. We want to keep in touch with this case and try to keep our listeners aware of these rather grave potential incursions on our constitutional rights.
Well, thank you, Peter B. Thank you very much. I appreciate you having us on. We will give you updates, and I think there'll probably be a few in the next few weeks, too.
Very good. Carl Mayer, attorney for Chris Hedges et al. In the case challenging the detention clause of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012.
Thank you, Peter B.
An estimated 80,000 American prisoners are confined in draconian, barbaric, solitary confinement. In our next segment on the Peter B. Collins Show, Sarah Sheward joins us. She knows about solitary. She spent 14 months imprisoned in Iran, some of that time, I think much of it, in solitary confinement. And she wrote an op-ed piece that was published on December 9 in the San Francisco Chronicle about what I consider a blight on the American justice system and the widespread use of what in California is called the SHU, the Security Housing Unit, where inmates are confined in very small spaces without human contact for years on end. Sarah Sheward, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Peter. It's great to be here.
And I'd like to know, based on your own experience in Iran, and there's a forthcoming book, and perhaps when you've published the book, we can talk in some detail about your experiences there. But in particular, you and your now husband, Shane Bauer, and your friend, Josh Fatal, were grabbed by the Iranians, and you were separated, and you ended up in solitary. Give us a description of the length of time and the conditions that you were held in.
Well, Peter, I was held in solitary confinement throughout the entire duration of my imprisonment in Iran, which was 13 and a half months or 410 days. In the beginning, I wasn't allowed to see my now husband, Shane, or my friend Josh at all. And eventually they would allow me to see them for short periods of time in the open air cell, which is sometimes is very similar to what we have here in the United States and often called a dog run. It's a slightly larger cell with tall stone walls and bars over the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So for 410 days, the only time I could see the sky was through the bars on the top of, over the roof of the open air cell. And the only human contact I had was with guards and very brief periods with my fiance and friend.
Mm-hmm.
And after a few months, my mind really began to slip. I experienced insomnia, really terrible nightmares, and I eventually started to have hallucinations and really violent panic attacks.
Mm.
I would spend a lot of my time just crouched down on all fours. There's a really small slot in my cell door, listening for any sounds from the outside world, trying to orient myself. And at times, I completely lost control and began screaming and even beating it at the walls of my cell.
Mm-hmm.
So this is called no touch or white torture. And since when I was freed and I came back to the United States, I was deeply shocked to find that literally tens of thousands of people are held in conditions in this country that are very similar to the conditions that I was in Iran, but many of them for much, much longer periods.
Yeah. Now, could you talk about how you marked the passage of a day? Give us a little description about whether it was lights on all the time, or if you were in darkness, if you were allowed to read or any other form of diversion?
Well, very, very slowly, over the span of many, many months, our conditions improved as far as having reading materials. The lights were never turned off. And I eventually had access to a television, which had a clock on it, and that helped tremendously. In the beginning, I mostly kept track of the days by the very small square of light that came through the high window in my cell. The window was covered with a thick sheet of perforated metal, which I think is also very common in U.S. prisons. So very little light came through, but it cast some light on my wall, which would slowly move across the room throughout the day. And I marked when I would get my meals and when I would be allowed to go outside, or not outside, but to the open air cell for exercise by the movement of that light across the wall.
And did you perform any exercise? Did you pace or do jumping jacks or push-ups, anything to try to stimulate your body and also pass the time?
Yeah, of course. Exercise is one of the only things that kept me sane. And kept me from falling into a really bottomless abyss of depression. I exercised as much as I possibly could, many, many hours a day. I meditated, I did yoga, I did anything I could to distract myself from my own thoughts and my own fears. Mm-hmm. I was held as a political hostage in Iran, so there was absolutely no legality. I had no access to a lawyer. I had no idea what my rights were, and I was in incommunicado detention. It was 6 months before they let me make a phone call to my mother, and at that point it was only for 5 minutes. And I only got two phone calls in a year and one visit. I couldn't write letters, so I was completely isolated. Mm-hmm. But I've found that those conditions are similar to a lot of the conditions that people find themselves in our own country.
And Sarah, there's this combination of deprivation of contact and the lingering feeling that you don't know how long this is going to last. And I have advocated for a number of life prisoners in the California prison system. And I'll add that these are not men who are held in solitary confinement, but they're serving open-ended sentences that are at the mercy of a politicized parole board and the quirks of who is the governor and whether he decides to allow someone to be released or not. So this becomes a kind of endless incarceration, and the mind-numbing nature of not knowing how long your sentence is something that weighs heavily on many of the men that I've talked to about this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we live in a country with the highest per capita prison population in the world. You know, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prison population. And this affects many, many more people than the ones that are behind bars. You know, it affects their families, it affects their communities. And the important thing about solitary confinement is that it's ineffective. You know, it doesn't prevent violence in prisons. It doesn't reduce it. There's studies that have been done that show that there's a higher rate of recidivism for once people are released back into society, they're completely unable to deal with life in the free world. And in addition, it's extremely expensive. It requires extra staff, extra services, not to mention all of the lawsuits that are filed against prisons throughout the country for using this inhumane practice. You know, I really want to emphasize that solitary confinement takes often very unstable individuals in the first place and drives them completely crazy in many instances. And this isn't good for our society. We don't want these people to be released back into our streets, but eventually and usually that's what happens. And there's absolutely no rehabilitation. You know, many people assume that the people in our country that are in solitary confinement, and estimates are that that as many as 80,000 people on any given day are in solitary confinement in this mm-hmm. country. Mm-hmm. The assumption is that these are the worst of the worst, but it's simply not true. Many people are put in solitary for very petty prison infractions. I read an article today about a man in Utah that has serious mental illness, and he was just put in solitary for 20 days because he didn't move his cup fast enough.
And Sarah, I'm aware of stories from Pelican Bay, California, where individuals are told you can get out of the SHU if you snitch on somebody. Now, snitching is a real serious issue, you know, in the loyalty of prisoners and whatever bond they forge behind bars. But part of it is almost tragicomic, because if you have been isolated and segregated from other prisoners for months, if not years, how the hell are you supposed to come up with some kind of information to snitch on another prisoner? And that is the kind of code that they enforce. And so people end up stuck in solitary, and it truly does go on for year after year.
Exactly, Peter. Our systems don't make sense. I mean, we've created a prison system that is really out of control, and the only way to maintain it, or the way that our prison authorities have resorted to maintain control is through isolation and punishment, and this clearly doesn't work. There was recently the U.S. defended the use of prolonged solitary confinement at a U.N. meeting in Buenos Aires, and there was a proposal which is supported by the U.N. Special Rapporteur on torture, Juan Mendez, that anything exceeding 15 days should be banned, any period in solitary confinement, and should be subject to stringent review. The U.S. rejected this proposal, and the other proposal at the meeting was that an absolute ban should be placed on vulnerable groups like juveniles, pregnant women, inmates with severe mental illness, mm-hmm. and the U.S. also rejected that proposal. What really doesn't make sense is why, when other countries have reduced the use, and so many studies have shown how ineffective this is, that our country is not stepping up to the plate. I mean, I believe that the U.S. should take a leading role in prescribing solitary confinement, because it's an inhumane practice. And under the Eighth Amendment, any treatment of prisoners that constitutes cruel and unusual punishment is banned and is considered torture.
We're talking with Sarah Sheward here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And for our listeners who are new to this subject, I'd like to refer you to a podcast that we posted at peterbcollins.com on June 22nd of this year, 2012. And it's a special report on California's barbaric solitary confinement prisons. And it includes interviews with Jules Lobel, who is now the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights and a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh. We talked to psychiatrist Dr. Terry Coopers, who describes the impact of long-term isolation on inmates, including depression, psychosis, high rates of suicide, and that, in particular, a catch-22 in the California system and perhaps elsewhere, that when you develop mental issues because of prolonged solitary confinement, and then you seek help for those psychological conditions, you are then typed as a psych patient, and the result is often more solitary confinement. And so the house of mirrors that our criminal justice and incarceration systems represent is something that is not apparent, I think, to most Americans, Sarah. They are informed by television and movies where the disposability of bad guys is seen as commonplace, and it reduces the prisoners to the level of animals. And we deplore that when it occurs in a country like Iran or when people were tortured in Egypt. And yet we have incredible powers of denial about what has occurred at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, at the Parwan prison at the Bagram Air Base in Kabul, Afghanistan, and at black sites, some of which have still not been identified. And so the disconnect that really can be reduced to contradictions and hypocrisy between the message that Americans embrace about freedom and liberty and the rule of law is belied by the actual practices that we conduct on a daily basis and that most people, as I say, are either oblivious or rationalize as, well, they deserve it.
Well, it's true, Peter, that most Americans don't know about the effects of prolonged solitary confinement or how widespread the practice is in our country. And, you know, one of the first, I think, most practical steps that prisons can take was something I discussed with Amy Fettig of the ACLU. They can simply do an audit of their facility and try to figure out why the people are in solitary that are in solitary, how long they've been there, and whether or not they need to be there in the first place. And in some states, a simple audit, for example, in Colorado, the result of a simple audit was that they were able to move 400 inmates from solitary confinement into the general population. And something similar happened in Maine because of the hard work of a lot of organizations, including the National Campaign, Religious Campaign Against Torture. Maine was able to reduce their prison population in solitary by 70% and to integrate them back into the general population because they realized these people were not a threat and they didn't need to be there. Another example is that in Mississippi, 1,200 beds, solitary beds, were shut down. They realized they simply didn't need them. So there's a trend happening in our country that not very many people know about, which is that prisons are realizing that this practice doesn't reduce violence and it's a huge waste of tax dollars. And it's a risk to public safety because when these people get out, as I mentioned before, they're not equipped to deal with free life. I mean, in my own case, my time in solitary, you know, scientific studies show that after even a few days in complete solitary, your brain waves begin to shift towards delirium and a state of stupor. And the only thing that I thought about for 13 and a half months was not being alone, was being able to be with my family and my loved ones, and to even spend more time with Shane and Josh was actually the thing I thought about all of the time. If I could just not be in solitary, if I could just spend more time with them, it would make prison so much more bearable. But ironically, when I was released, I found social interaction to be extremely difficult. I found it difficult to make simple decisions for myself, like what to eat or what to wear. I found it very difficult to make eye contact, and I was jumpy and didn't want to have physical contact even with people that I loved. And I found that I wanted to be alone a lot of the time, which depressed me because I finally didn't have to be alone, but I was so used to being alone that being with people was difficult. So I've started to look into a little bit the situation in Europe, and specifically in the UK and Britain. They tried using solitary confinement for several years, and there was public outcry. It was clear that prison violence didn't go down, and they eliminated the practice. Now in Britain, the number of people in solitary confinement is almost negligible. And instead, they've instituted a system of violence prevention in their prisons, where if there's an infraction or a problem with a prisoner, they give them a way out of solitary immediately, within days. They give them opportunities to prove that they're ready to reintegrate into the general population. They give them more responsibility instead of less responsibility. So there's lessons that we can learn from what other countries have done and what other states are doing. And, you know, what we really need is to apply these in California. California has more prisons, I think, than any other state. And the situation with solitary has gotten completely out of control in our own state.
You detail in your article that there are 12,000 California inmates in at least 8 prisons who are protesting these conditions, and that, we have some people. This is what really stunned me, Sarah, when I did the interviews for the package this past June, is that the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU are pursuing legal action, and they feel that the best attainable result would be to get the state of California to put a 10-year limit on a single stretch of solitary confinement. And what I learned from that is that there are some men who have been in solitary for longer than 20 or 25 years. And given what you described about your own symptoms that surfaced during and after your experience in Iran, just imagine if you multiply that by 25 years. And it certainly reaches a standard that any average person would describe as cruel and unusual. And yet the courts are not sympathetic to that argument. And they often, almost always exclusively, side with prison management that they need the discretion to control the behavior of really bad prisoners. That's the meme. That's the anecdotal reason that they give to support this.
Yeah, I can't imagine, Peter. 25 years in solitary confinement is far beyond anything that I can imagine, how a human being can cope with that amount of time or what it does to them mentally. I think what we need in order for these policy changes to happen in California, as they have in other states, and in order for there to be, what we really need, which is an international ban and a national ban prescribing the practice of prolonged solitary confinement, what we really need is a major shift in public opinion. And we've started to see that in the last year or so, starting with the prison hunger strikes that you mentioned in California and the congressional hearing led by Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. We've started to see, and there have been a lot more articles written, a lot more studies and campaigns are being are out there, and a lot of people are hearing about it. But it's clear that having people in solitary confinement isn't doing anyone any good. And the economic incentive, I think, in some cases has worked because we're in a recession and solitary confinement is costly. And, it reminds me of the argument that Frederick Douglass made about slavery, that there's always going to be a lot of people pushing for the moral imperative. And with solitary confinement, that is the strongest argument, in my opinion, that I don't care if a person is innocent or guilty, we have no right, and it doesn't benefit society to torture them. But if the economic argument is going to get people out of solitary, I think that's fantastic. Douglass said the same thing about slavery. Whatever, the right thing needs to be done, and however we can bring it about, we need to bring it about. We need to get these people out of solitary confinement, and we need to stop torturing people in our country.
Well, and there are some encouraging signs, Sarah, because voters in November approved by a 70% margin modifications to the draconian three strikes law that was passed back in the early 1990s. And we came within 4 percentage points of eliminating capital punishment in California. And you were just saying, the arguments for eliminating the death penalty were partly based on moral arguments for people who were open or willing to hear that, and partly based on practical considerations, that it is not a deterrent to other crime, and that the cost of the death penalty process, the legal appeals, maintaining the death chamber and death row, all amounted to a burden on the state that was not producing any benefit or a meaningful cost-benefit ratio. So I do think that we're seeing a shift, and I just hope it will continue. The problem is it comes back, in my view, to the media, that television treats this as entertainment, that movies serve up these larger-than-life evil figures, and it makes it very easy for people to rationalize brutal punishment.
Yeah, exactly, Peter. You know, what I would really like to end with is just to remind listeners that we in our country have a tremendous responsibility to fight against the use of prolonged solitary confinement. We have more people in solitary than in any other country in the world, over 80,000 people on any given day. And in our country, it's become a routine administrative practice when really it should only be used in as a very, very last recourse in exceptional cases to prevent death or bodily injury or in some sort of major breach of prison security. I believe that the more people that know about this, the more prison officials hear from the people in their state, and the more our federal government and the UN hears from us about this, the more likely it is that policy change can happen.
Well, I also think that people need to speak one-on-one with legislators, because ever since the Willie Horton campaign of 1988, and he wasn't on the ballot, but Willie Horton was used, to defeat Michael Dukakis. And ever since that, Democratic politicians in particular, who are described as liberal on so many issues, have moved to the right on criminal justice and incarceration matters, and they believe it's purely defensive. They're afraid that if they take a stand for what is just and also what is practical, that they'll get clobbered at the next election. And so people need to reassure, particularly the insecure elected officials, that we do support their efforts to change these draconian practices, and that we will be there if they are targeted at the next election. I think that is a critical part. The other piece is that the very powerful prison guards union here in California is they've got a lot of internal problems, and they have financial problems, and they are not the political force that they were from basically 1998 through the Gray Davis and Arnold Schwarzenegger administrations. And so when you combine that with the electoral shifts that I described a few minutes ago, there are opportunities, but people of conscience and people who recognize this as a blight on our system need to speak up and need to speak directly to our elected officials, because they're the ones who are afraid of being soft on crime and having it end their political careers.
I agree, Peter. And I really appreciate you having me on the show today. One of the most moving and I think revealing comments on solitary confinement that I've read was from Nelson Mandela in his autobiography about over 30 years in the prison, in the horrible prison system in South Africa. And he said that all of his experience, all of his years in prison, nothing was more dehumanizing than solitary confinement. And I believe it was around 2 weeks that he spent in solitary confinement. And he said the absence of human companionship was the worst thing that he experienced in all those years. So I think that the fight to end solitary confinement is a moral imperative, and it's also a strategic way to tackle our prison system, our prison industrial system, because it requires, ending solitary confinement will require a systemic change and a shift from a punitive approach to a restorative approach, which is what we need in our prisons. So thank you very much, Peter.
Sarah, thank you for speaking up, and I really appreciate you joining us today. Sarah Sjord, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Well, I guess we got some work to do on that home of the free, land of the brave. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.